Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Muy buenos dias. Muchas enchiladas, everybody. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. Great to have you here. My number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Chances are, if I had to guess, chances are, at one time or another, if you've ever been on an airplane, the thought has probably crossed your mind, what if something happened to the pilot or pilots, as the case may be? And would I ever have to fly an airplane and try to land it? I don't know. I mean, I've thought about that before. Have you ever thought about that before? Well, that became a reality for a guy just yesterday who had that very experience. This is down in Florida, an amazing story. And we've got some audio. Thomas, you have the audio ready for this, right?
No, I do not. Let me take a look.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-oh. Well, all right. Well, then I guess I'll just... I thought we had audio. Don't worry about it then.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Anyway, so here's what happened. A passenger with no flight experience safely landed a private plane at Palm Beach International Airport this past Tuesday after the pilot suffered a medical emergency. Now, they don't say what the medical emergency is. I'm assuming it's something like a heart attack. In a published blog, the FAA said the pilot told his two passengers he wasn't feeling well. He fell against the controls. You never really want to see that, right? If you're up in the air and the pilot falls against the controls.
No, that wouldn't be good.
Unconscious. Yeah. You never really want to see that. That put the aircraft into a nosedive in a sharp turn, which is also never a good thing, if you ask me. The blog said one passenger grabbed the controls, pulled the plane out of the nosedive, and radioed air traffic control in Fort Pierce. I would not know which button to press to rate. I think it's on the yoke, if I'm not mistaken. So he acted quickly. He says, I've got a serious situation here. This is all on audio. And if we had the audio, you'd be able to hear it. But we have the audio is there, and we'll try to get this posted on the show Twitter feed so you can listen to it. So he says, I've got a serious condition here. This is the passenger speaking, telling air traffic control, my pilot has gone incoherent. I have no idea how to fly the airplane. And the air traffic control person says, Roger, what's your position? The passenger says, I have no idea. I can see the coast of Florida in front of me, and I have no idea. So he's told, maintain wings level and just try to follow the coast, either north or southbound. We're trying to locate you. 4 minutes go by, and the passenger tries to figure out what he's supposed to do. So he radios back. He says, have you guys located me yet? I can't even get my navigation screen turned on. It has all the information on it. You guys have any ideas on that? Eventually, the air traffic controller locates the plane on radar. It was flying just off of Boca Raton. And that's when air traffic control at, Palm Beach, took over and was able to talk the passenger through a safe landing. Air traffic control said over the radio, you just witnessed a couple of passengers land that plane. It really wasn't a couple. It was one, from what I understand. Another voice responds, did you say the passengers landed the plane? I guess it was a pilot. That's correct. Oh, my gosh. Great job, he says. Aviation expert John Nance said, it goes well beyond just a great job. This is the first time I've ever heard one of these things being landed by somebody who has no aeronautical experience. He says he's heard of passengers landing planes before, but not a plane as large and complicated as a Cessna Caravan. The person on the airplane who had no aeronautical experience listened carefully and obviously followed instructions with calm. That's what made the difference. More complicated than a trainer aircraft, the private pilot was impressed by the video. He too comments on this. The name of the passenger has not yet been released, nor the name or the condition of the pilot. But the FAA is simply saying that he suffered a medical emergency and they're investigating. What a wonderfully great ending to a story that could have been just terrible. So he paid attention. He did what he was supposed to do, and he was able to land the plane. And when you watch the video, it looked as though a trained pilot was landing the plane. It descended normally. It just touched down, as you would expect a plane to do. But the guy flying it had no prior experience doing that. And maybe if there's an analogy there somewhere, maybe the analogy is that God has revealed to us how to live. Here's a God door, I think. He's revealed to us how to live. And maybe you're going to be in experiences or situations that you've never trained for before. You've never been in these situations before, much like that guy. And suddenly now you're faced with, what do I do? Well, if this analogy holds, do what you're told to do. Follow your conscience. That doesn't mean, of course, do what you think you'd rather do. Following your conscience means do what you know deep down inside is the right thing to do. And often the right thing to do is the more difficult thing to do if you're faced with a couple of choices. More often than not, take for example, eating broccoli is better for you than eating a Whopper with cheese and bacon. The Whopper with cheese and bacon, by all accounts, tastes better than a bowl of broccoli, if you ask me. But deep down inside, you know that it's better for your body if you eat the broccoli than to eat the double cheeseburger with bacon, etc. So there's a food analogy. But in a situation like this, look to divine revelation. Look to, what did Jesus say? What does the Bible say? What does apostolic tradition say? What does the church teach on this issue? And that will help guide you so you can land your plane safely. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Marino in Roy, Utah. Good morning, Marino, and welcome. You are number one, first in line. Welcome.
Hey, cool. Thank you. God bless you. I have a question about watching documentaries or movies about infamous people or people who've done terrible things or lived scandalous lives. How does the sin of detraction or gossip play into that if I say, hey, I watched a good documentary about so-and-so, you should watch it?
Oh, okay. So is this somebody like, Bonnie and Clyde or some public figure, some notorious person that you're finding more about?
Joseph Stalin? Just that, or crime documentaries sometimes I watch about people who've done grievous things. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how is that a sin of detraction or gossip or anything if I want others to watch it or say I found it intriguing or something?
Yeah, I can imagine. By the way, there is no such word as grievous. That's a non-existent word. The word is grievous. So just
grievous.
A little
there we go.
Yeah, yeah. I hear it at Mass sometimes when we're saying the Confiteor. I confess to Almighty God and to you, my brothers and sisters, that I have greatly sinned. Through my fault. And I hear some people say, through my most grievous fault. But it's actually grievous. Mm. So there is no such grievous word as grievous. Yeah. Anywho, back to what you're talking about. I could maybe imagine a scenario where something like that could cross the line into detraction. Now, detraction is the intention to destroy the reputation of somebody else. People have a right to their reputation. They have a right to their good name. And you and I don't have a right to destroy through detraction somebody's good name, their reputation. However, there are plenty of situations in which the person has destroyed his own good name by public scandal, by crime, by doing things that are just publicly reprehensible, or they are deemed reprehensible by the public and the story is known. So if you're watching, let's say, a true crime story about somebody who committed a murder, no, that's not detraction. That's a matter of public record. And the person has already destroyed his own reputation. He no longer, in a certain sense, you might say he no longer has a right to a good reputation because he's demonstrated that he's of ill repute. So he has demolished his own reputation. Now, historical figures, people in the media, the Michael Jackson saga and all the weirdness that came out about his private life. I mean, I would say that the more public the person is and the more the actions that got him in trouble or her are public, the less you would ever have to worry about it being the center of detraction. But the caveat here might be if it's somebody who's not a public person, who has no impact on your life, and who indeed has done terrible things, but it's not necessary that everybody know that, then in that case, I would say you wouldn't want to cross that line because that could wind up landing you in the sin of detraction. But to watch something on television, a true crime TV show or a movie or a biography, a documentary about somebody who has done something like that, whatever that may be, No, I don't see in any way how that would cross the line into the sin of detraction or calumny for that matter.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Good answer. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. Let's go to Andrea now in Monticello, Minnesota. Good morning, Andrea.
Hello, Patrick. I wanted to get your thoughts. My brother asked why the animals didn't eat Noah in the ark. My mom asked him if he thought that God had the power to affect the animals in a way that would help Noah. I wanted to ask, could it be possible that God put them back in the original state at the beginning of creation where the animals didn't get were at peace?
That is a very deep and interesting question, Andrea. First, before I answer, may I ask how old you are?
This is her son.
Oh, 11. I'm sorry. So you're not Andrea. My mistake. It says Andrea on the screen. What is your name?
Joshua.
Got it. Okay. And how old are you, Joshua?
11.
Right on. Okay, so there are a couple aspects of this that are interesting. Let's consider the first one. How is it that the animals didn't just eat Noah and his family? The thing to keep in mind is that in the ark, we're not told by in the Bible what actually happened in the ark, other than a few things like when Noah sent a raven out to find some land, see if the waters had receded. He sends a dove out. So we know a few details like that, but we otherwise don't really know what happened in the ark. And so we can only guess. And therefore, I will guess that in some way that we don't know either, Noah had these ferocious animals in pens that were so strong, like for lions and, you know, and lions and tigers and bears, that they couldn't get out and they couldn't eat him. What about snakes? That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how he would have made something so tight that a snake couldn't get out of it. But we don't have any information that there was anything like that happening in the ark. We're not told that any of these creatures got out and harmed any of the human beings. It seems that none of them were harmed because we see all of them coming out of the ark and all of them starting life over again after the ark. So obviously none of them were killed. So we just don't know. We can only guess. Now, there was a movie that came out, I don't know, 5-6 years ago about Noah. And I think it was called Noah. And in that movie, they guess and they show what they think might have happened, that Noah, he had some kind of like smoke. He made some sort of a fire with something that put the animals to sleep. Now, it's obviously not going to put them to sleep for 40 days and 40 nights. But it may have been that whatever this was kind of like a sedative. I don't know if you know what that word sedative means. It means like it will calm you down or it might make you sleepy. There's certain drugs that can make you feel that way. So that's another guess. Maybe there was something he had on the ark that he could use. Maybe it was smoke. And this works for bees, by the way. If you talk to a beekeeper who's going out to gather honey, and if the hive is all, you know, they're all very excited or very angry, well, smoke will put the bees to sleep, as I understand it. And so maybe it was something like that. And that's what that movie shows. But as to the second part of your question, no, I don't think that God in any way changed the animals to be like they were in the Garden of Eden. I don't think that was the case. Again, it's a guess and anything is possible, but I don't think that's very likely. I don't think that is likely to be what God had done. I think it would probably be something more natural, more scientifically explainable, like very strong cages and maybe something to make the animals calm. So those are my thoughts on that. Joshua, what do you think?
I don't know. Well, if it was that it was strong cages, the animals would have had to gotten in and out freely.
Right. Well, another possibility is we know that later on, a lot later on, when the Israelites were escaping from Egypt, and they were going to go into the Promised Land eventually, God worked a miracle so that when Pharaoh's chariots were chasing them as they were crossing through the Red Sea parted, as you probably know, a miracle took place, the waters parted, the Israelites were able to go through where the water would have been. And then once they got up to the other side, when Pharaoh's army was in the middle, God caused the waters to come back down, and it drowned all of the people who were chasing the Israelites. Maybe God worked a miracle like that. Maybe God made all the animals hibernate for 40 days. Maybe God made all the animals just be quiet and stay calm. He can do that, of course. We just don't know. So maybe he did that before they went into the ark. And then when they were coming out of the ark, they were in that same state, and then they woke up, so to speak, from that. I guess when we get to heaven, we'll find out, right?
Yeah. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Well, Joshua, keep thinking these deep thoughts. I'm glad to hear that you're thinking about those things. That's good. And tell your mom that I said thank you for letting you call me. 888-914-9149. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back. Well, this is Open Lines. 888-914-9149.
888-914-9149. He built it out of a hickory bark. He built it long, both wide and tall. Plenty of room for the large and small. Who built the ark?
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
I haven't heard this one in a while. That's right. Okay, we'll scoop it out now. 888-914-9149 is the number to call to be on the air. I've got an email here that comes in from Akiko. She says, Patrick, I'm a fan of your show, and I've been listening to your show for many years now. She says a few other nice things. I'll just skip over all that. She says, yesterday on your show, a lady called in asking what would be the best way to help someone like a homeless person when approached on the streets. One of your suggestions was to put together and have on hand care packages to pass out just in case to those in need. I thought that was such a wonderful idea, and I might try doing that myself. You also mentioned how you once gave alms to a homeless man who was sitting outside a church by reaching into your pocket for loose change, which you placed into his tin can. However, instead of expressing gratitude, you were dismayed when this man became upset and threw the coins at you and the can in your direction. Yeah, I don't think he was homeless. He was just panhandling. You know, he might have been down on his luck, but as I discovered, this was in Buenos Aires. Not that that matters, but that's where it took place, coming out of church one day. And he just got really angry, and he started shouting at me and cursing at me because I gave him the coins in my pocket as opposed to something more. And he flung the money at me. That's what she's referring to. So she says, some time ago, I experienced a similar situation when approached by a homeless man standing on a street corner. He asked me for money, but all I had was coins. I didn't have any bills. So I responded by emptying my wallet of all the loose change that I had and handing it all to him. I thought I was doing a good deed until he turned to me and began shouting obscenities. He was angry that all I had given him was a bunch of coins. I was startled and honestly quite angry at this man's lack of appreciation for what I thought was an act of kindness. But obviously, the homeless man didn't think so. And from this experience, I learned a valuable lesson. I began by asking myself, what if I was this homeless man? How would I react? How would I feel if someone just tossed me a few coins? While I definitely wouldn't yell out obscenities, I'd probably feel quite insulted and would question my worth in the eyes of people. After all, these days, especially now with hyperinflation, a few coins won't even buy you a cup of coffee and a donut. Now when I'm approached by a homeless person, which nowadays happens more often than not, I try to give as generously as I can, in bills, not coins. And when I give, I never question how that money will be spent. I just give from the heart and with a smile and a friendly God bless you. Sometimes when I don't have cash on me, I will offer to buy food or groceries for that person. Mother Teresa once said that we should give until it hurts. I suppose what I'm trying to say is that we should not give just for the sake of giving. We should give. We should keep giving. We should give, keeping in mind the other person's worth and dignity as a human being. I was thinking that if Jesus was holding out a can and begging for alms, would I just toss him a few coins and walk away satisfied that I've done my good deed for the day? I guess giving someone coins is okay if that's all you've got, but I definitely think bills are better. Thank you and God bless you, Akiko. Well, Akiko, thank you, first of all. That was a really thoughtful email. Thanks for taking the time to sit down and write it. And I hear what you're saying. I understand your point that being generous is always going to be better than being stingy. But not that I'm defending myself. I'm not defending myself. I don't feel like I need to defend myself, but I didn't think of it as being stingy. I just thought of it as, okay, he's got his cup out. There's a bunch of people coming out of Mass. I happen to be one of them. Nancy was with me. And other people are putting money in there. It's not like I'm the only one. So it just didn't occur to me other than, yeah, sure, I'll help out. And I dug into my pockets and I pulled out whatever coins I had. And who knows how much that came to, probably no more than the equivalent of a dollar or two. And I put it in there. It wasn't as though he was going to starve that day if I didn't give more money, because I was just one of a bunch of people who was doing it. So I guess in context to me, it didn't seem, and still doesn't seem, as though it was paltry. But you're making a good point, and I accept it, that there are times when you recognize that you could make all the difference. But let me give you a devil's advocate, kind of something for you to think about. I don't know where you live, because you didn't mention it to me. Not that that's important, but if you ever are in Phoenix, the general Phoenix area, and you don't have to be in the city, you could be out in the burbs, there are sections where it is a full-scale business that's being run by people unknown, and there are people who work shifts, and they, in certain big intersections, and again, where I've seen this mostly would be out in the suburbs. So a big intersection with lots of cars going in both directions. And there will be a quote-unquote homeless person, a bedraggled-looking guy. Typically, they're men. Sometimes they're women. And they'll be standing right on the median or on the corner where people are going to pull up to make a turn. And they've got the big bucket. And they all have the same kind of bucket, too, which is interesting. And they're all standing there, and they collect a lot of money because people are good-hearted like you. And they roll up, and they see somebody in need, so they give them some money or they give them, you know, whatever they can. Well, I've had some conversations with some priests in the area who've been there their whole lives, and they say, this is a business. So there are some circumstances, this would be one of them, where they're probably not homeless, or at least they're not homeless intentionally. This is their job, and their job is to collect money by panhandling. And so when their shift is over, a new crew shows up and takes over, and they get some percentage, some cut. Maybe they're paid so much per hour, perhaps. I don't know the inner workings. But that money that that man collected, who looks like he just slept under an overpass last night, that money doesn't go to him. That money is going to whoever is running this business. Who is that person? I don't know. So my thought would be, just maybe to kind of balance out what you're saying here, would be that we should be prudent. We should be generous and liberal always in giving to the poor and put them first and you know, let God sort the things out later if it turns out that you gave money to somebody who wasn't really deserving of it or didn't really need it, perhaps. We'll let God sort those things out. You do the best you can and move forward. But there are some times when you can tell that giving money, and maybe giving a lot of money in some cases, may be the wrong thing to do. So my default, and I think you and I are on the same page here, my default is always and everywhere, if I can help, I'm going to try to help. I remember being out with friends one day, and we were at In-N-Out Burger. And there was some guy who was, you know, looking pretty scraggly and looking like he wasn't doing too well. So he came by me, and I just said, hey, man, are you hungry? He said, oh, yeah, of course I'm hungry. And I said, well, just stand by. What would you like? And, you know, got him a hamburger and a Coke and some fries. No big deal. you know, not hardly any money at all. And besides, it's In-N-Out Burger, which is awesome. And don't start up with me, everybody, about Whataburger and Five Guys and all that other stuff. It's scientifically proven that In-N-Out Burger is the best hamburger on the planet. Okay, so
your hamburger comes with a dose of misogyny.
The ghost of Cyrus is lingering. He's out today. Well, thank you, Thomas. You done good, young man.
I try.
Let me hear that again. Crank it up.
Your hamburger comes with a dose of misogyny.
All right. Well, not that day it didn't. You know. Not that day it didn't. I didn't order it with misogyny. Didn't order it animal style either. And it wasn't a protein version. But anyway, anywho, to your point, Akiko, I think that there are times when maybe giving somebody a meal is the very best thing to do. Because in the moment, that's something they could really use. So I'm with you. We just have to be, as Jesus said, wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Let me share with you a story, as long as we're on the topic, that I wrote years ago. And this is about something that happened even longer ago than that. And it's a chapter in one of my books. The book is called Life Lessons, 50 Things I Learned in My First 50 Years. I wrote that over 10 years ago. And here is the little chapter called The Beggar. One evening, on my commute home from a long day at the office, I stopped at a gas station mini market to refuel and grab a cup of coffee. As I got to the entrance, a bedraggled young man of about 20 stepped nervously toward me from the shadows. "Please, sir," he said in a low, faltering voice. We locked eyes for an instant. I sized him up before glancing away with a grimace of irritation. He seemed kind of scared, as if he were about to cry. Ashamed of begging, perhaps. "Please, sir, I'm..." "Sorry," I cut him off, raising my hand dismissively as I walked past. Once inside, I poured myself a steaming cup of freshly brewed coffee, tossed a couple of 20s on the counter, and told the clerk, "I'll have this coffee and give me the rest on pump 7. I headed back out, sipping my coffee and thinking, "I hope that beggar's gone by now." No such luck. There he was, standing silently in the same place as before. I strode by, pretending not to see him. I pumped the gas, got in my car, and drove out of the parking lot, coffee in hand, as I thought about how nice it would be to get home to my easy chair and a glass of wine and the delicious dinner my wife had cooked for me. That's when an explosion of remorse burst in my conscience. In a flash of shame, I realized just how selfish, uncaring, and hard-hearted I had just been to that young man who needed help. I had brushed him off with the contempt that often comes easily to those of us who have the comfortable necessities of life, and then some. "Get out of my way, Jack," this contemptible attitude growls. "I don't care. I don't want to be bothered. Your problem isn't my problem." What an insensitive, self-centered jerk I was. I turned the car around and headed back to the gas station, this time hoping and praying that the young man would still be there. And he was, still standing in the shadows. I got out of my car and walked toward him, seeing the same despair and embarrassment on his face as before, but also something else. A flicker of fear crossed his eyes as I approached. This time I spoke first. "I'm sorry," I said to him quietly, in an unsteady voice clotted with shame. "I'm sorry I didn't help you. It's just that I..." His eyes widened as I took out my wallet, and without looking down to count it, I handed him a wad of cash, everything I had, maybe $40. "I'm really sorry," I stammered again as I turned to walk back to my car, my head down, tears in my eyes. "Thank you, sir," he called out to me. "God bless you." I've never forgotten that young man. Our chance encounter changed me for the better. Through it, the Lord gave me a searing glimpse of myself in the mirror of truth, the painful truth that though I had always thought of myself as a good and faithful follower of Jesus, I was really, in many ways, when you got right down to it, selfish and apathetic toward the poor and disadvantaged. My arms were loaded full with the good things in life with which God had blessed me. A beautiful wife and family who loved me, a comfortable home, plenty of food and drink, a car, a good job, some money in the bank. And yet I couldn't be bothered to share even just a tiny portion of these blessings with someone who had none of those things. And to make matters worse, I very nearly walked away from a huge blessing from the Lord in the person of a beggar who helped me realize my own deep need for conversion. I thank God with all my heart for that painful moment of grace, for nudging me to turn my car around, go back to that gas station and help Jesus standing there in the shadows. He changed my life. So even as I share that story with you, I'm done reading it now. Even as I share that story with you, so certain emotions, you know, are coming to me. One of which is now many years later. See, when that happened, all my children were still kids. They were all still, you know, they were all still at home. Quite a few of them had not yet been born yet, as a matter of fact. But one of the things that getting older does for you, and it has for me, is now as I think back on that incident about the young man, about 20 years old, I think to myself, how did he get there? What was his backstory? You know, you see beggars and you just sort of take them for granted. They're like, you know, they can be like, if you're not careful, they can be like furniture or, you know, a tree or a shrub or something. It's just there. You don't really think about it. You don't really look at it even. It's just there. And for you and for me, maybe people who are homeless or down on their luck or on the street, poor, what have you, they can become like that. They can become invisible. So as I look back on this now, 30 plus years in the future now, 30 plus years later, the thought that first comes to my mind is, what if that guy were my son? My son. My youngest son just turned 21. And he was about the same age. Might have been 21, might have been 20, right in that age. He looked scared, as I remember. I'm glad I wrote this all down long ago. I'm glad I put it on paper so that it helps to refresh my memory. But I do remember this scenario. And I remember, you know how when you go into, especially in Southern California, I'm not really sure what this is like in other parts of the country, but certainly in Southern California, Circle K, 7-Eleven, gas station mini markets, they're everywhere. And you know how they've got the big white, like, ice freezer right in the front? It's kind of like parked right out on the sidewalk in the front. And that's where the ice bags are. So when you go in to get your whatever, you might buy a bag of ice. He was standing kind of under the eave of this mini market. It was a busy place, cars coming and going, people coming and going. And he was sort of next to this big ice freezer where the ice bags are and like a trash can. And it was dingy and shadowy. And he was just sort of standing there. And I think he was like waiting to see if there was somebody who had a kind look about him. And I don't think that I probably did. I don't know why he asked me, but maybe he was just desperate. I don't know. But I think about him and I imagine, what if that was my son? And how did he get there? How do you wind up panhandling in front of a mini market where you don't have the means to drive someplace? Maybe you don't have the means to, in those days, there was no Uber, but you know what I'm saying? And so in the years since that time, it really made me think about that. And when I go back to that incident in my mind's eye, I imagine, what if it were my son? And how would I hope and pray that other people would treat him if he was down on his luck and maybe, you know, nowhere to go? And just asking people, can you help me? Can I get a little something? For me, it just completely changed. It revolutionized the way in which I look at people like that. Now, you may say, well, you should have been thinking about that before. Well, true. Okay. Yes. I admit I was a jerk. I wanted that guy gone. I didn't want to see him. When I went in to get my coffee and such and pay for my gas, and I was hoping he wouldn't be there when I came back out again. And in all truth, the reason was because I didn't want to have to think about, maybe I really should probably help this guy. If he's not there, I don't have to worry about it. If he's there, I have to, you know, bump into this sharp edge of reality that, oh yeah, that's right, I'm a follower of Jesus. And what did Jesus say? Yeah, take care of the poor. So for what it's worth, looking back on that incident all these years later, it just really makes me think about my own kids and now my grandchildren. This idea of other people being kind to them. So, for what it's worth, 888-914-9149. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. You can call in if you want. We have an unusually large number of open phone lines this morning. That's really weird. And I don't like it. So why don't you call in? We'll get you on the air with your comment or question. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower. Your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep our stations running. Join in with hundreds of other listeners who have donated their used vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking
Whoa.
About henna.
Welcome back. That's quite a song. 888-914-9149. We'll go to Cindy now in Minnesota. Cindy, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. This is a really emotional topic for me.
Did you say it's Maureen? I apologize. It said...
No, it's Cindy. It's Cindy. I said it's a very emotional topic for me.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yes.
My brother has been homeless in Colorado, and my dad rented an apartment for him, and he brought all his street friends in, and they destroyed the apartment, so my dad was on the hook for that. My dad kept giving him money and money and money, enabling him. He had been in the military and had apparently some sort of honorable discharge because he has military benefits, thank God. But he doesn't work because it's too stressful for him. And he told my sister that when you see the people out on the street with their signs, they call that flying the ninja flag. They collect whatever they get, and then they barter. Everything you give has a price on the street. And so I think it's better to give to the shelters, the people that actually can try to make a difference mm-hmm. for these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I saw what it did to my dad. It destroyed my dad.
I'm curious to know, in what form did that take? It destroyed him financially or just emotionally or both?
Emotionally. Mm-hmm. After he retired, he would just sit there and worry about my brother nonstop.
Yeah.
It destroyed him. Mm.
Did your brother ever get off the street?
Temporarily, he'll go to VA housing and he'll get, you know, straightened out, and then he can't take it. He doesn't want to have a job. So, you know, and then it's a back and forth thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we pray he gets his act together, but, you know, and then he's looking for my sister for handouts. And it's like, no, she has a family. No.
Right.
Get a job. Right. Be responsible. You're 55 years old.
Never married, I presume? He's just lived that way his whole life?
Oh, he's been married couple of times.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what a tragedy, and how mysterious it is. I mean, that's how it strikes me, Cindy. It's mysterious. Why would somebody not want to get out of that situation? I don't understand it.
I don't either. And he's made threats to me against me in the past, so I don't even really have a relationship with him. So it's sad. It really is.
Yeah, I can easily understand why this is emotional for you. So what's your takeaway from all of that then? What's your advice for people who may be in a similar situation where a loved one is just not willing to get off the street or not willing to get into something more stable? What do you recommend to them?
I would say don't enable them, but pray for them. Let them know that you love them. And give to charities that actually are on the streets helping the people, because that's where it's going to be.
Is he doing drugs at all? I mean, I don't need to pry into his life, but I mean, is it
probably
a drug or,
you know,
or alcohol
sure
issue?
Is. And he was an alcoholic, and I think he was adopted, and I think he may have had fetal alcohol syndrome, as you know, looking back over the years.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's a lot of things they have to help themselves. They have to want to help themselves.
Right. Do you remember a time before he got this way when things were happy or when he was normal, quote unquote normal, and you had a good relationship? Do you ever think about that?
It was when he was very, very young.
Yeah.
Because he grew up resenting me as the oldest sister. So, anyway. It just, it's sad.
Yeah. Well, I will pray with you for healing for your family and healing for him. There's, at some point, maybe he'll turn a corner. I know it's painful to watch people go down that road, but maybe he'll turn a corner. Does he have any faith at all, Cindy? I mean, does he believe in Jesus? Does he pray? Do you know? Or is it too far gone to really know at this point?
When my dad died, the deacon at our home parish talked to him, and he said he did have faith. But I, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think he's definitely not a practicing Catholic.
Yeah. Well, here's a thought. You know, let's end on a positive note, if nothing else. You know, maybe some evening you can call into the Family Rosary Across America and ask Father Rocky and Margaret to pray for your brother, give them his first name, and then you'll have a whole bunch of people all around the world who can pray for him, and maybe there's a miracle waiting to take place, and God's people will have a role in that. Wouldn't that be awesome?
That would be awesome. Thank you for that great suggestion. Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Cindy. Thank you. I'm so sorry about the pain involved. When I think about that, you know, it just brings me back to the guy that I wrote the story about. You know, who knows what his backstory is, and how did he get there, and what was his reason for panhandling, and why did he look scared, and why did he look like he was about to cry? I'll never know unless I meet him in heaven. He'll probably beat me there, but I'll never know. And I wonder about that. And so for me, another takeaway, kind of listening to what Cindy had to say, is to see people like this, homeless people, vagrants, bums, you know, whatever term people wind up using about them, to see them as people, to see them as actual men and women. You know, this is somebody's son. This is somebody's brother. This is somebody's daughter. And the humanizing effect of what I think of anyway, it makes me think of it, if nothing else, that we should see them through the eyes of Christ. We should look at them the way Jesus would have looked at them. You know, when a leper came up to Jesus, ravaged and disfigured and probably terrible to look at and all of the above. And like in Mark's Gospel, chapter 1, one of these men, these lepers, comes up to Jesus and says, I know that if you want to heal me, you can heal me. And we're told that Jesus looked at him with compassion. He saw him with compassion. And I don't know, the deeper we dig into some of these stories and think about what they mean, maybe for me that's another big takeaway, is the whole idea of having compassion. I want compassion for me. I like it a lot when people are compassionate toward me. So what did Jesus say? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So if you, like I, like compassion, I don't know anybody who doesn't, then maybe that's another thing for you to think about as well, is that to what extent are you showing compassion to others? And maybe you're doing great in that department. Maybe you are. Praise God if you are, but not everybody is. Let's go to Jesus now in Naples, Florida. Hi, Jesus.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, good morning. What's on your mind this morning?
Good morning. Well, you know what? I have been on both sides of that issue.
Oh, yeah?
I have looked away from people in need of help. And as an addict, alcoholic, I have found myself on the streets all over this country, in jails, in institutions.
Yeah.
And I have felt hopeless and lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And
how old are you now?
You know, I don't even. I'm 53.
Okay.
53, and you know, I don't even know. Let's say, you know, you guys talk about Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if I'm a Christian or not, but I do believe that there was a man named Jesus, or Jesus, or Yeshua.
Mm-hmm.
That was an incredible, incredible man, and he showed so much love and that word compassion to everyone he came across.
Yes.
And I want to be more like that. And yes. I'm so grateful that in my life, when I've been at my lowest point, there have always been people there willing to help me best they can.
Yeah.
The other person I was talking to talked about enabling. You know, I was taught a long time ago that we feed the hungry, we shelter the homeless, and we clothe the naked. And that is not enabling ever. And telling someone you love them and that you're here for them and offering them maybe not monies to use drugs or alcohol, right? But a piece of your sandwich if you can.
Right.
You know, right. To sit down with them and have a conversation, one human to another. You know, a lot of these people don't even have that because we look right past them. I say we because I have been guilty of that.
So when you, so you have been on both sides, this is fascinating. What was it like for you when you were invisible to the people in their cars or with money coming and going, and you realized that you were invisible to them because they weren't looking at you or they didn't want to look at you?
You know, I don't know if they want to or didn't want to. I know it's just a hard reality. Sometimes is very harsh. And me personally, and possibly other people, when I'm faced with a dilemma or faced with fear or insecurity, sometimes it's easier for me just to look the other way. And, you know, that just, it really breaks you down even more. It makes you feel like I have no chance at all. Mm-hmm. And when I have felt like that, I've harmed myself, harmed other people, and just had a horrible attitude. You know, no chance of ever getting out. But there is always a chance.
How did you get out? Changes. How did you turn the corner? I hope you did turn the corner, right?
Well, you know, today I'm clean and sober, but I've had my challenges. I've gone periods of time where I have been and periods of time where I haven't been.
Yeah.
But ever since I found out about sobriety and about making these changes, I haven't gone back to homelessness. I have afforded myself a small place to live by working, you know, for the things that I need.
Right.
But, you know, people gave me so many chances and opportunities. They never gave up. And I think that's very important, is that we don't give up on the people that we love the most. You know what I mean?
I do.
I don't mean that you go out and buy somebody, you know, a brand new car, or take someone into your home that you're afraid that they might, you know, hurt you or hurt themselves. You know what I'm saying? But there are things we can do. And yeah, if you want to help people that are trying to help themselves, you can find them in places that deal with sobriety, in places that deal with homelessness. You know, those people, for whatever reason, have decided to try to come off of the street, try to seek some help. And we can break bread with them. We can let them know. You know, sometimes the talk of Jesus and of religion might be too hard of a pill or too big of a pill to swallow at certain times. Because when you have been down and out, I will blame my higher power for allowing this to happen, even though I might have caused it myself. Now, there's so many people on the street. Some of them are schizophrenic, bipolar. Some of them are convicted pedophiles or convicted murderers. They can't get jobs. Some of them are drug addicts and alcoholics. But you mentioned Jesus and a leper. Mm-hmm. And I think that Jesus, as a man, never turned his back on anyone from what I know, the little I know of him.
Yeah.
You know, my name
You're
is
right
Jesus
about
that. In English. And I go through this all the time. You know, when I tell people that my name is Jesus, they tell me, no, it's not. Your name is Jesus. My reply to them is, why? Do you speak Spanish? You know, because we can take it back. Jesus' name, Yeshua. Jesus' name, you know, Isis, or I don't know how the Greeks pronounced it. Let's not get anything confused. What we call.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jesus. You know, one thing that I would just mention for your consideration would be, you're right about Jesus. You're right about, he was a great man. He helped people. He didn't turn anyone away. But there's something to that story that I'm sure you've heard of before. I just want to mention it. And that is that after he was crucified, he rose again from the dead. And there were countless witnesses who saw it. You know, people who knew him in life, they knew what he looked like. They broke bread with him. They spent time with him. And then after the resurrection, when they saw him again, they saw that he had come back. He was risen. And the interesting thing is that he had been claiming before that point that he was actually God, you know, God who became one of us to save us. And the resurrection really changed everything, because now you've got all these people who saw with their own eyes that he had a lot of great ideas, and he sure did help a lot of people, and he performed miracles and things, but he also rose from the dead, and he appeared to me, and he showed himself to me, and I talked to him, and in some cases they ate meals with him. And then after he ascended back into heaven, the authorities, they didn't like the fact that all these people were talking about Jesus having risen from the dead, so they started to clamp down. And when the persecution started, so many of these people, when faced with the choice, you either recant and say that Jesus didn't rise from the dead or we're going to kill you. And so many of them, they couldn't recant because they had seen it with their own eyes. So all I want to say, Jesus, and I'm so glad you called. This has been a wonderful conversation.
You can call me Jesus. Okay, you can call me Jesus if we're speaking in English.
That's fine. Podemos hablar en español también si quieres. But in any case, Jesus, think about that, you know, and maybe ask the Lord Jesus Christ to manifest that truth to you, that he is indeed God. And as you know, he loves you. And I'm so glad you called, Jesus. Thank you for that. In ways that you don't even know. I'm grateful. I'll be right back.